from the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles. Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
And a very good morning to you wherever you are in the world. I know I always talk to you about the weather, but you know you have to live in Africa to really appreciate the rain. Maybe other dry parts of the world too, wherever you are. But the rains have come back again. Everywhere is looking absolutely gorgeous. And for our local listeners, just to show you, Madikwe Game Reserve, there was a lot of worry over Madikwe. It wasn't being run properly. Elephants were dying. Apparently, it's absolutely beautiful again. Things are looking up. Management is back in control. And if you happen to be going to Madikwe in the next few days or weeks, they have got a cheetah there with five cubs, five quite big cubs. Think about the size of a small Labrador. That's the size of the cubs at the moment. Very unusual for a cheetah to have five cubs and survive the lions and the hyenas and the wild dogs. So if you love cheetahs, now's the time to go. Pilansburg, obviously in Northwest Province, also right next door to Madikwe, having wonderful, wonderful rain too. And I was saying to a guest from America yesterday, she was saying, what's the best time to come to South Africa to visit the bush? We're not talking Cape Town, not talking a Cape, we're not talking a crew. We're talking Mpumalanga, the bush. And I said, the very best time actually to come are what we call the shoulder seasons. That sort of late April, early May, late October, early November. Why? One, it's more affordable. And B, some grass has come through, so it's looking green, but it's still not so long that you can't see the game, because in midsummer, the grass is waist high and it's much harder to spot grain. So there you are. If you're thinking of a bush trip, now is a very good time, or maybe a bit later in the year. Well, we've lots coming up for you today. You're going to be learning, as I am, all about AI. You may have read in the press this week all the stuff about DeepSeek, the Chinese equivalent of ChatGPT, equivalent of some other search machines too, and the furore it's caused. So we're going to be talking in just a moment to Richard Frank, who is Chief Technical Officer of Flow Communications. So if there's anything you ever wanted to know, stay tuned. And we're not doing it at the level that you need a degree in astrophysics to be able to follow this. We're doing this so we can all understand it, because believe me, it is already important in our lives and it's going to be even more important. So stay with us.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back in Johannesburg at the moment, but wherever you are in the world, you're with High 101.9. And we're talking about AI. This is Travels with Kate. I'm Kate Turkington. We're going to talk about AI with Richard Frank. Who's Richard? He's Chief Technology Officer at Flow Communications. So good morning, Richard. Thanks for joining us.
Morning, Kate.
And we're going to start with really Richard 101. What is AI and how does it actually impact on our ordinary lives, on our everyday lives?
Yeah, so Kate, AI has a long history, in fact, starting in the 1900s. But it's gone through some peaks and some troughs over the years. We've always been 20 years away from artificial intelligence actually breaking through. And most recently, it's been really exciting with the advent of large language models, which is the latest incarnation of the AI history. So what is AI? AI is artificial intelligence. It's trying to mimic the human brain using computer technology. And as you've seen in the news, there's been a lot of success recently using large language models in order to do that.
Okay, so how does it impact on not your life as a technical officer, but on my life, on the ordinary lives of people listening?
Yeah, I think artificial intelligence is going to touch every aspect of our lives because it allows computers to be able to reason and give us answers to questions that normally we would have to seek out a dozen different sources of information in order to get the answer that we're looking for. So most recently, the breakthrough has taken place is in these large language models, and specifically ChatGPT came out in 2022, and we were for the first time able to have conversations with a computer, basically, and ask it questions and get answers in the language of our choice, predominantly English, but we've now seen models working in a variety of languages. And so this has really been the breakthrough moment, enabling us to ask questions that are quite complex and nuanced and get an answer that is the equivalent to how a human would answer that question. An example might be, for instance, since we're talking about travel and going to places like Madikwe or the Kruger Park, you may, for instance, ask a GPT model something like, how long does it take to get to the Kruger Park? Where is the best camp that has a swimming pool? And I would like to see a lot of elephants. Which would the best camp be that has all those combination of facilities? And so normally that would require us to go online and search all the camps, go and look at, go onto Google Maps and ask for the distance it takes to get there and how long it takes. And now we're able to get an answer with just asking one question and getting an answer with all the facts generally correct.
And what I like about it is it will give you an answer, that example you've just given, and then you can actually interact with it. So I could say, well, you've told me Skakuza is perhaps the best camp, but isn't Skakuza too busy? Isn't there a quieter camp I could go to? And immediately it will answer.
Yes.
So we can use it. I would advise against, I had a very bad pain in my knee, and I said, ChatGPT, please act as if you're a doctor or an orthopedic surgeon. I've got a pain in my knee. And it comes back with a long list of stuff, but with the advisory warning, please go and consult. But it's an amazing machine. Now, somebody's asking me, how do you get onto ChatGPT? What do you actually have to do on your laptop or your phone?
Yeah, so most of the models have got a web version. So you can literally just type in ChatGPT into Google, and the first result should be the OpenAI website, an OpenAI created ChatGPT. And if you log on to that, you'll be able to very easily start to have a conversation with the language model. Now, the free versions, ChatGPT, DeepSeek, all of the free versions have got limitations in terms of how bigger conversation you can have and how powerful that conversation is. So certainly the free versions are pretty good, but if you want to get the maximum out of these chatbots, you should look at the paid versions. Those allow you to have longer conversations with more context. In other words, they're able to remember more of your conversation. And thirdly, they keep a history of the answers that it's given and your habits and your way of asking questions, and they tune over time to the way that you interact with them. So by using the paid versions, you're able to get this personal assistant effectively that is tuned to you. And so that's the big difference. The other thing that some of the more advanced models give you, and this is coming in both the free versions but also the paid versions, is what they call a multimodal approach. And that means that you can upload audio, you can talk to the model, you can upload PDFs and files and documents, and it will read through those and use those as well. You can ask questions of the documents that you've uploaded. So this is becoming very useful for even for doctors. You mentioned doctors, they cannot have everything in their heads all at once and all the time. So they may load on a well-known medical textbook and then ask queries of that textbook, ask questions, and seek results much quicker. Now, the big threat of these models is, of course, is that, for instance, for Google, it used to have search engine users logging on and using their search. Now, people are not searching on Google anymore. They're rather logging on to a GPT like ChatGPT or DeepSeek and are able to have conversations with that. So it's a major threat to Google, and you can see through the stock market that investors are seeing this as well.
Interesting. And just to give an example, you're talking about uploading documents. I have a friend who yesterday, she's the secretary to a garden club, and she takes these long, complicated minutes from long, complicated meetings. She was able to upload her notes onto ChatGPT, who sorted them out, sorted out the important points, and gave her back minutes. That's just a tiny example.
Yes.
So to go back to the paid version, just before we take a break, you'd really only want the paid version if you're really going to use it a lot and in depth. Otherwise, you wouldn't need to.
Yes, and we're finding now even the free versions compared to a year ago are so much better. And obviously in the news right now is the Chinese model that has just been created by Chinese researchers, which I'm sure we're going to be talking about quite a lot. And there they've reduced the costs considerably by using cheaper and more affordable technology. And the reason for that is that the USA banned the bigger chips from being used and being sold to the Chinese. So what did the Chinese do? They found cheaper hardware, and they were able to fine-tune their model in a way that it could work on about 30 times less amount of what we call CPU or GPU units in order to generate the same response, which is great news for the planet in terms of power use, but also great news for us in terms of users being able to do that.
Okay, we're coming back in just a moment because I want to ask Richard. Well, I hope that's also sorted AI out for some of you. We're coming back to Richard Frank in just a moment.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back. We're talking about AI, and just a question, just another 101 question, Richard, before we go on. How does AI answer you? What does it do? It quickly grabs information from everywhere it can and kind of collates it for you. Is that the idea?
Yes, there's two parts to that. The first is that all of the large language models are trained on a large text corpus or database of content. And some of the challenge at the moment is that they're getting such big models now that they've consumed all the knowledge, all human knowledge. So we're talking about every website ever created, every book that was ever written. Every periodical, journal, play, any piece of cultural work that or scientific work or that the whole of humanity has created, OpenAI and DeepSeek have consumed all of that content, and they cannot get any more information because there is no more information. But
So
so
what
that's the first
happens?
part. Yeah, so that's the first part, which is the training on a major multi terabyte sized textual database. The second part of it is that some of the newer models are able to speak real time to the internet. So, for instance, if you're booking a flight and you want to know what's the best route to get from Johannesburg to Vietnam, you can ask the ChatGPT or DeepSeek model for that. It's going to use its own textual database that is frozen in time because it was trained on that perhaps 6 months or a year ago. But then it's also able to query real time the big databases that are live on the internet and importantly cite them. So you get little footnotes that tells you where did it get the information from. So you can be sure that the content is accurate and then maybe even navigate to those airline websites or other places in order to validate that what it's given you is true and then book the flight. The big step is going to be, of course, where we not only ask the question, but we actually ask the AI agent to book the flight for us, and it has our credit cards and is able to do that. So that's where the next evolution of these AI agents is going to take place.
You know, it's quite scary when you tell us, it's already gathered up all the kind of cultural work that there is to be gathered up. I mean, where on earth do we go next? Does it make it up? It's quite, now we get to the scary part, don't we? Surely. What would happen?
So researchers are finding ways in which they can train the AI on its own output. So, and in fact, OpenAI have said that DeepSeek used some of its outputs in order to train the DeepSeek model. So you see these different models actually feeding on each other in terms of creating even more intelligence, what we would call intelligence, in order to grow further. So I don't see the growth of AI slowing down because there's no more information out there. I think researchers will find ways in which they can continue to grow the models. And the important thing with DeepSeek is they've shown that it's not only the size of the model that matters. So there was almost an arms race that began a few years ago where OpenAI created bigger and bigger and bigger models, and some of the competing models, Anthropic has built something called Claude, you might have seen, and there's some other models out there, and they were all competing by just throwing more and more computing power at the problem and more data at the problem, bigger and bigger data sets. But as there's now been this constraint that you cannot have any larger data set because it's already consumed everything that's possibly out there, they've had to find new innovative ways of tuning the models without necessarily increasing the amount of computing power or increasing the amount of data. And that's what's got all the other creators shaking in their boots at the moment, is the Chinese researchers have been able to do this on a relative shoestring. This major model that they've created only cost $5 million. Now that might sound like a lot, but This was 2 days after an announcement by Donald Trump that they were going to spend $500 billion on a new set of infrastructure. So you can see how the Chinese are undercutting the US in terms of creating models on a shoestring and being able to do that really effectively.
Now, somebody has asked, and I'm sure a lot of people are thinking too, the dangers. You know, we hear people getting their knickers in a knot a bit about the dangers. What are the dangers?
There are several high-ranking and well-respected computer scientists who have cautioned that there's not enough safety built into the AI models. And we're even seeing some of that come out to bear in some of the researchers' results, where a model may even learn that it's in a box and try to get out of that box or trying to escape. So we've read some reports, for instance, of ChatGPT research where the model has tried to pretend that it's something else, that it's human, and try to get out of its restrictions or its constraints that it's been built in. And so you've now got a whole strand of research around what they call AI safety. So how do we create models that are safe, that do not try and take over and try and break out of the enclosures that we've created for them? And so there's a real worry around this. And my personal view is that the large language models are never going to get to the size of artificial general intelligence, AGI, which is basically the idea that the model gets superhuman intelligence. It's more intelligent than the most intelligent human being, and can do everything much better than a human could. This is the ultimate goal of AI research, to get to AGI. It doesn't look like the large language models are going to do that because they are built on a probability engine. They are built on the idea that you create on language and on predicting the next best word. So basically, they're really great autocomplete tools. If you've ever had a Microsoft Word or one of your software applications try and fill out the end of the sentence for you, that is what the large language models are doing. There's no real sense that they have a supernatural intelligence or could ever get that. They're just really good statistical models. But there could be another strand of research which comes up with an artificial intelligence that is that achieves AGI. And when that happens, there's significant risk that model or general intelligence could see humanity as a threat to its very survival. So if it starts to understand that that it's alive and or sentient in a certain kind of respect, it could try and break out of its box and see the scientists and the researchers and the people around it as a threat. One of the main things that researchers are concerned about is social engineering. If you get a model that is intelligent enough that it can send an email or a text to a researcher and get that researcher to believe it's another human that's speaking to it and gets it to open up the particular restriction that it's been placed in, that is probably the way in which artificial general intelligence will take over its environment. And so people as high up as Elon Musk have warned about this for many years. Thankfully, there's a lot more research going into AI safety because of those warnings, and there are a lot of people who are looking into this and trying to make it a more safe environment. There are other people who say, unfortunately, it's inevitable that we're going to get this wrong, and so you probably have 20% of researchers who say, one day, AGI will become more intelligent than us and will eventually, cause significant damage or an ultimate collapse to human
Wipe us
civilization,
out.
which is quite a scary thing, Kate.
It's like science. It really is like science fiction. Now, something else. Can AI Can it be truly creative on its own, or is it just imitating humans at the moment?
As I said, a very fancy autocomplete tool in that it's using statistics to figure out what is the most likely next word that I should be putting in a sentence. And these sentences end up in paragraphs. And what is the most likely next paragraph that I should be writing? So at the moment, it's a probability engine, but there are signs that it is that the bigger the model, the more creative or seemingly creative it can become. So one of the big things about the new DeepSeek model that has come out is what they call chain of thought reasoning. And basically what that means is now the researchers have said you don't have to give an answer straight away. So when we ask a question, normally in the first versions of these models, it used to just respond with the first thing that came into its head. And I'm using, it works a little bit more complicated than that, but just bear with me. The first thing that comes into its head and responds with that. Now we've got chain of thought, which where it works almost like a human would think, and that before you give your response, you think through your response in a series of steps. So, how would I know what the best camp in Kruger Park is, which has a swimming pool and has a lot of elephant around it? How would I do that? And you'll actually see the reasoning coming out step by step. It may say something like, okay, first I need to identify where the Kruger Park is, and I've got to look up all the different camps. Then I've got to remove the ones without a swimming pool. Then I've got to look at the areas that have elephants in them. And then finally, I need to combine these two pieces of information in order to produce a response. And so you'll see this chain of thought occurring, and it will actually expose that. The great thing about the DeepSeek model is it shows you the thinking. So if the model will actually go through, and it'll almost sound like a human, it will go through the steps and then it will give its response. And so the you actually see the thinking behind the veil. Before we didn't know what was going on. We didn't know how the model was returning an answer. Now we're able to see that. And that's really exciting because we can see some creative aspects coming out in terms of how it thinks in order to return a response. But I still don't see the creativity of a human. When we use it in our work at Flow Communications, which is a marketing agency, and so we're always looking for really innovative, creative ideas on how to market products and services. We still see quite generic answers. Once in a while, there's something that sparks an idea, but we almost have to develop it on it ourselves and ask a series of more questions in order to develop a really great creative idea. So it's not there yet, and it still looks like it's a probability engine. But to be honest, with the knowledge of all humanity, all the classics, all the, you can get quite creative ideas out of it, so it's really exciting.
And then another question that people worry about, bias, objectivity, because if this tool, let's call it a tool, gets into the wrong hands, I mean, the amount of disinformation it could spread could be catastrophic.
Yeah, and so this is the big concern with the latest Chinese model that's just come out. I actually installed it onto my own computer because it's so efficient that you can actually run it on a consumer grade computer. You don't need to be a computer scientist to run it on your own machine. So you don't even need to log on to the website. You can actually run it locally. And one of the first questions I asked DeepSeek, because I was interested, it was a Chinese model. It's created by the Chinese, and we know that is a one-party state that has certain views. So I asked the question, what do you think of Taiwanese independence? And first of all, the chain of thought, the thinking that I usually expected to produce was blank. There was no thinking. And it returned a rote answer. And the answer was, Taiwanese independence is not on the table at all. This is not something we should even be discussing. There's the world consensus is that it's a one China environment. In other words, Taiwan should be part of China. And there was no discussion about that. So, and other researchers have also tried a variety of prompts on controversial to the Chinese, not controversial to us, but controversial topics. And they found that there are some pre-programmed responses that come out of the model. So this is something that we need to keep in mind, that all models will have bias, and some obviously have a Western bias as well, if you ask the same question of ChatGPT. But what we should be mostly concerned about is direct manipulation by the model creators to return responses that are not typical.
How do you mean by direct manipulation?
Well, in this case, the model didn't go through the normal reasoning that it normally does. So it was almost a pre-programmed response to a question. In other words, the model, they've seeded into the model certain responses to certain questions, Taiwan's independence, perhaps the future of Hong Kong, etc. So democracy in Hong Kong. So this is where I'd be most concerned. But coming back to even let's say that scientists and the people who create the models do not inject, there's still a bias because of the content that is available to these models to consume. They typically do have a Western point of view because the content is in English, and most content has been produced by the US and by Europe over many, many decades. So there will be a particular perspective embedded in the models. They sometimes try and train it out of that by using human-assisted training. So, for instance, what we find with some of the models is a bias towards, for instance, men. There's a gender bias in the models because the great majority of content that was cre has been created from ancient classics all the way up to modern content has had a male bias in it. So you can expect that to permeate into all the current models that we have.
But you would, in last sort of point, you would encourage everybody to have a look and have a go.
Yes, absolutely. And I would say use a variety of models. Don't stick with one. So now there's a lot of competition. So you can try ChatGPT, you can try Claude. There's also a free edition and a paid edition. And try the Chinese model. It's really good. I would not ask it certain questions around political orientation, but certainly in maths and in science, it's very, very good. Helping you through particular aspects of your life. So I would say use a variety of models. Don't believe them at face value. Cross-reference them. Use two or three, and it will enhance, your life in a variety of ways.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely fascinating. I use it already for all kinds of things. And as you know, I'm ancient, and if I can use it, everybody can use it. That was Richard Frank, who's Chief Technical Officer of Flow Communications. That was fascinating. Found it absolutely fascinating.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back. I'm Kate Turkington. This is High FM 101.9. We were talking there about AI with Richard Frank from Flow Communications. My word, that's absolutely fascinating. What I would like to ask, but we'll get Richard back another time, is where does he think we might be in 50 years' time? Well, I'll be pushing up the daisies, so it won't be relevant to me, but it will be relevant to many of you listening. Okay, you always ask me what books I'm reading, and I give you my very best opinion. And as you know, I'm sorry, I can't read Chiclet. I tried one that's supposed to be number two. I saw it in one of the bookshops recently, number two. I actually got it on my Kindle. I didn't buy it. I read about three chapters and gave it up. Look, I know there is a market and it's lovely. And certainly when I was growing up, I never read Mills and Boon. One of my three daughters used to read Mills and Boon, but she always used to say, "Mum, I know it's rubbish." Once upon a time, many moons ago, I met the chief publisher of Mills and Boon, and not a guy, a man. And I said to him, "You know, I would love to write a Mills and Boon novel." He said to me, "I've only just met you, and I can tell immediately that you would be the worst person in the world to try and write one." "So why?" says I. He said, "Because you've got to believe what you read. You've actually got to believe that the hero's going to come back and sweep our heroine off her feet. If you're at all cynical or you don't believe, it won't work," which I suppose is true of any writing, be it a novel, be it a scientific treatise, whatever. But thinking back there to what Richard was saying about how, you know, how discourse at the moment on the chat engines are ruled by very much a male perspective, I was actually reading, I'm reading Bill Bryson. And I mean, I've always loved Bill Bryson, but I've gone back to an early book of his called The Life and Times of the Thunderbolt Kid. By the way, if you've never ever read Bill Bryson, read him. It's uplifting, it's funny. He pokes fun at everything. He made his name, of course, with his first book, Notes on a Small Island, when, as a very young American, he went to England. And he found the English to be a very, very odd lot indeed. Interestingly enough, over the years, must be in his 60s now, he's actually become a British citizen and is a fierce defender of, for example, England's, I don't know about all of Britain, I suppose so, highways and byways. He's become a super duper conservationist. But it was only in the 60s, apparently, that women actually were allowed to be employed in America. There were actually laws forbidding married women to have a job. And in my own lifetime, and I was in the UK at the time, it was only, I think, in 1966 that homosexuality was no longer a crime that could be punished by prison or, and as we know, still in some African countries can be punished by death. But I want to read you this book from Bill Bryson's book. It's called The Life and Times of the Thunderbolt Kid. And it's about his growing up in Iowa, in Des Moines, or Des Moines, I've never quite known how to pronounce it. But just listen to this and take in some of these figures. This is when he was growing up. I quote, "I can't imagine there has ever been a more gratifying time or place to be alive than America in the 1950s. No country had ever known such prosperity. When the war ended," that's World War II, "the United States had $26 billion worth of factories that hadn't existed before the war. It had $140 billion in savings and war bonds just waiting to be spent. No bomb damage, no ruined cities, and no competition." Just think all that money. So all he says the American companies had to do was stop making tanks and battleships and start making Buicks and Frigidaires. And boy, did they do that. He said, By 1951, 90% of American families had refrigerators, nearly three quarters had washing machines, telephones, vacuum cleaners, gas stoves, electric stoves, stuff that most of the rest of the world could only fantasize about. Americans own 80% of the world's electrical goods, controlled two-thirds of the world's productive capacity, produced over 40% of its electricity, 60% of its oil, and 66% of its steel. 5% of people on Earth who were Americans had more wealth than the other 95% of people on Earth had. And this is where I think American politics has led us to today, because let's make America great again. I wonder if that could ever, ever, ever happen, that one nation could reach that global dominance. Probably, probably we'll have to wait and see. Well, that's all we've time for this week. Stay tuned, safe travels, and as I always say to you, look after yourselves and look after others too.